Okay, y'all. Welcome. Welcome to day two. Yes, file in. Feel free to grab a clipboard. We're just getting started. Yes, welcome. It's good to see you all again. I see a lot of familiar faces, some new faces, so welcome. We'll do a little bit of a recap so that folks feel up to date if you weren't here yesterday, but we're just going to dive right into it. So if you're here for, you know, a little more of the organizing spiral that we teased yesterday, this is part one of what will be the multi-part process. And today we're going to focus around listening and learning within the organizing spiral. Oh, and just in case anyone has any questions, my name is Ian West. I go by E. Pronouns are they, them. I'm a faithland organizer at the Church Council at Greater Seattle.
And I'm Melly, also a they, them. I'm also an organizer with the Faithland Initiative of the Church Council at Greater Seattle. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for being here. We know we're at, like, the afternoon slump spot, so we really appreciate it. Thank you for coming out. I know I'm taking a nap right now. Anyway, moving along. So just a little bit of a roadmap of where we're going to go today. So, of course, right now we're in the midst of the welcome. We'll get into what we call a bit of a beyond land acknowledgement in a second here. Then Melly will lead us through a session one recap, like I mentioned. So we'll go over some of the values that we uplifted yesterday and talked about, and a little bit more of the organizing spiral, just so, once again, folks who weren't here feel like they can still engage. Then we'll move into a little bit of our framing around listening and learning, specifically coming from the context that we're coming from of accompanying faith communities who are looking to equitably steward their land. So we'll have some examples of what that's looked like in other contexts that hopefully kind of grounds us as we enter into our activity. After that, we'll do a very brief, we're going to call it a training. It's more of a reminder because I feel like we've probably got some organizers in this room. I just feel that energy in this room around one-to-one meetings, because after that brief overview, we're going to go into those one-to-one meetings, specifically under sort of the framework of land stories. So we'll talk a little bit about what a land story is, the fact that we did not make up this concept. It's really coming out of, I mean, many different lineages. But just letting everybody know what it is so that then we can, you know, enter into the process informed and having a good time talking about it and thinking through, you know, what is our relationship to land in a variety of ways. From there, you can refer to this when we get to that point, but there'll be sort of a breakdown of time, so some time to prepare your land story. If you're the type of person who likes to write, that's why we have the clipboards. We'll get into some pair shares, so you're going to find a partner to have that conversation with. This is not going to be some sort of a perfect, you know, your magnum opus of your land story. We don't believe in perfection, right? Everything is iterative. But it's just going to be a time to jot down some notes, share out as much as you feel like you're able to and you would like to. Each person will have 10 minutes. We'll go over this again. And then we'll get into a group sharing time. So as folks feel led, we can get a little bit closer, ideally, in the space. We feel a bit more, you know, a bit more intimate and have some, yeah, just have a group sharing moment around these land stories. All of this will build as we go through the rest of the week, so this is, you know, a building block as everything else is. And then last but not least, of course, we'll have a preview for the rest of the week, so to keep whetting your appetite. If that making sense to everybody, what's feeling clear? All right, beautiful. Okay, so yesterday we went through a rather lengthy land acknowledgement and also put up this slide. We also know that you all are probably experiencing the Holden Village land acknowledgement pretty frequently in the various spaces, and spaces as far as physical spaces and also facilitated spaces that are offered this week. And so we really wanted to, you know, acknowledge, of course, the land that we're on and bring back this consideration to kind of segue us into the rest of our time here today. Coming from President Robert Larson of the Lower Sioux Indian Community, an apology or an acknowledgement is one thing, but what are you going to do next? And that is really kind of the theme for the rest of this week.
So just to recap, we talked about how important it is that any organizing we're doing in the organizing spiral is built upon moving out of white institutional values and into transformational values. So some of the tools that we provide folks that we're accompanying to help them kind of break it down and see how this is showing up in their lives and their actions, but then also their faith communities and larger organizing efforts. So those look like competitive individualism, either or what we might call binary or black and white thinking, a scarcity mentality, and secrecy, which we want to always clarify is different than confidentiality. Secrecy is withholding information in order to conserve power. And the net effect of those sort of values result in relationships misshaped by consolidated power and hierarchical accountability. So what we might call a power imbalance. So while we're disrupting those values, we kind of believe one of the fastest paths towards creating a liberatory space is to put our energy and focus into what we're trying to sort of facilitate or birth into the world. So that would be our transforming institutional values, both and thinking, or what we might say in Spanish, porque no los dos, an abundant worldview, using resources responsibly and also recognizing when you have enough, but believing that there is enough for everyone. Transparent communication and decision-making, and then collaboration and cooperation. So nurturing individual creativity, kind of disrupting competitive individualism, accepting and celebrating people for their strengths as they are. And the result of that is accountable and responsible relationships, which is what we're trying to cultivate when we're doing community organizing with broadly shared power in a non-hierarchical structure. So this is our organizing spiral. Once we've kind of done that important intentional work of making sure that we're rooted in transforming institutional values, we kind of start along this trajectory, just to remind folks that we start in the center, but that means we start with listen. And we move from listening and doing that sort of deep uncovering of, what exists, who we have around us, all of those sorts of things, and moving into learn, gaining the skills and information that we need in order to take an action. And then we act. And after taking any sort of action, it's always important to have a sacred pause to reflect, to kind of attend to any harms that may have happened as a result of our actions, to find out what went well, what we would like to replicate again in the future, what folks felt about it, thought about it, did it make an impact, did we move farther from our intention along the trajectory to making that intention a reality. Then we start again. We have new learning and listening to do. We will come up with new actions that move us farther along the path. We're not starting at the end result, right? We can have these lofty goals for what a liberated world looks like, but we won't get there unless we take the steps that are right in front of us right now. So this spiral kind of expands outward to reflect that. But the more times we complete the cycle, we're building on each previous cycle and deepening our connection and our reach and community. So before we dive into listen today, we want to talk about dignity taking and restoration. So how many folks have heard the word reparations before? Great, you've been going to the other sessions. Love that. this is something that we talk a lot about, and it's kind of becoming a buzzword in the zeitgeist these days, folks talking about like Venmo transactions as reparations, right? But what happens when something like land theft occurs is so much more than the theft of the monetary value associated with that land. And so Bernadette Atuene is a property law scholar who focuses on land stolen specifically in Africa, and for folks who are living in the U.S. as part of the African diaspora. So dignity taking is a term that she coined to describe when a land and way of life has been stolen and dispossessed individuals at a systemic level. We see this all the time, whether it's like Wells Fargo stealing folks' homes in Detroit, Michigan, or larger land thefts and deforestation that occurs in other countries. So reparations as we understand it, right, the restoration of like a property or an amount or a value of something that has been taken is not enough. Giving back the land or assigning a dollar amount to it isn't going to actually benefit folks to the same degree that they were impacted and harmed by taking it. So dignity has to also be restored and reinforced by more powerful systems than the ones that enabled the dignity taking in the first place. And from our values, right, we know that that powerful system has to be non-hierarchical. That has to be collective. So we have to restore the life, the culture, the sense of belonging and safety of folks who have been impacted by dignity takings. So dignity restoration goes beyond reparations and says that it shouldn't be based on the actions that have happened in the past, but on the current access to the land and its associated benefits. So something that might be rooted in the past, right, is when you see a placard that gets put up and says a massacre happened here. Mm-hmm. What's that done for the survivors, right? Nothing. So that's what we mean by saying not focused on what's happened in the past. We're not saying that the history doesn't matter. We're saying that to fix the history, the present has to be different. So listening is the first step towards dignity restoration, because the first violence to deny the people's autonomy is the disregard or denial of their voice. It starts there and then moves on through their communities, even to their, you know, persons and bodies. So deep listening can become a restorative act, but it requires that, you know, for folks on the other side of the harm, we have to do a lot of work to mitigate our biases that keep us from truly seeing, hearing, and understanding each other. And there's a lot to that. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But meeting as equals often means that we have to do work to ensure that the folks that we're meeting are on that level with us, because they have been disproportionately impacted and harmed. So we have to do a lot of prep to ensure that if we're meeting, trying to reach out, build a relationship with folks, that we're meeting in ways that support the life, safety, culture, and sense of belonging of those folks. And it's okay to not know how to do that. Most of us don't, right? That's a difficult thing to learn. We don't know who we don't know and who we don't have in our community yet. So it's okay to not know. What's not okay is to assume that you know. Mm-hmm. So always being willing to ask, to listen, and then respond. So there are three kind of major points to this, right? The first is timing and place. So who are you meeting with? And how are you meeting with them? Like, in what context? And under what circumstances? For how long are you meeting? And when are you meeting? Those might not seem like things where you need to take a person's culture or identity into consideration, but you do. Also, when it comes to like our physical bodies, have you taken into account this person's access needs? Particularly with folks who have experienced like a lot of violence and trauma, you know, we know that these things can cause like disability and additional access needs that we might not think of. So that can look like hearing or language access, making sure that there's like translation or interpreters so that someone can hear something not only in English, but in the language that they prefer. Also, mobility. Can they physically access your space? A lot of the times the answer is no. There are people that we don't have in our communities because they cannot physically access the space. We haven't made it accessible to them. So there are people's voices who are lost just on that basis alone. So a lot of work has to be done to reach folks where they're at, build that trust. You can't always change your building overnight, but you can change where you meet. So taking those things into consideration, also things like digital accessibility, transportation, you know, other physical accommodations. And then also mind and spirit. Like, think about the time in this person's life. Do we know them very well? Are there things that are going on in the world that might be impacting them that they might be really busy dealing with, right? Especially when we're talking about meeting with community leaders or leaders of busy nonprofits or things like that, folks that we're trying to get in touch with, like, take into account the larger things that are happening there. Are they likely to be mentally present? Are they going to be emotionally available? And is there repair of past harm? Like, has there been a rift between your organizations in the past or among your social circle? Any other support that's needed in order for them to be fully present also has to be considered. I'm going to take a deep breath and another drink of water. Facilitating in a mask is hard. I just want to ask, does anyone have any sort of symptoms or feeling unwell, sore throat, anything like that? Okay, awesome. I'm going to take this mask off. Is everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
Great. Facilitating your mask is super hard. I'm getting that thing where my cheeks are sticking to my teeth, so things are very moving. All right. So it's important that we have examples of folks who do listening well. So one of those people is Louise Brady. She's known as the Herring Woman. She has done a lot of activism in her community to save the herring. She likens it to the dying out of the buffalo for Great Plains tribes. So the herring are in decline due to a variety of environmental factors like overfishing. And one of the quotes that we shared with you yesterday is, "Activism is making coffee, serving elders, cooking, getting to know each other in a very deep way to develop that trust so that we can have joy." And I think that's really at the heart of what we're trying to get people to understand when we talk about what listening is. It goes beyond hearing folks. It's being in, like, deep community with another person. So one of the things that she has done is to focus on the people who are most vulnerable. And that starts with the herring, because the herring are the individuals, the relatives that are the most difficult for the people in power to hear. So she was considering, you know, her teachings about the herring and realized that they had not had a ceremony for the herring in some time and decided to hold that ceremony and also to make it a community event where all were welcome. She talks about how folks in her community had historically been divided or kind of siloed according to different titles, but that the Heron need all of us, and in order to make that happen, we needed to have a community ceremony where all are welcome, and to provide that space so that the Heron's voice could be heard also at the same time. So she organized that ceremony. They've had a few since then, and they've grown larger and built a great amount of community power as a result of these ceremonies. People are more educated in their community about the issues that the Heron face. They're learning how to take care of the Heron. They're learning efforts and ways to get involved, and they're also learning who are in the positions of power that are making these decisions from within their community. So now instead of meeting someone in the context of, like, they're in a position of power, I'm not. They don't have to listen to what I say. As part of a community, it's different. Those folks want to hear what their neighbors and their friends and other folks have to hear when they're sharing a meal. So that's part of what her work has been. It sounds really small, but it's actually been widely impactful. And she's a very prominent leader in environmental justice today. So when we talk about listening, we're just kind of revisiting what we talked about yesterday. Listening is the foundation of trust. It's a way to embody empathy and solidarity. True listening creates the possibility for us to co-create the beloved community, God's movement in the world, learning and unlearning more about the stories, people, places, and land around us. The tools we use to practice listening are as simple as they are effective. It looks like one-to-one conversations, which we'll practice today, community conversations, community-centered research, person-centered planning, and supportive decision-making.
So, why are one-to-one meetings important? Oftentimes people will ask us, you know, I already know all these people in my congregation. Why do I need to talk to them again? I've been going to church sitting in the same pew for 20 years. Literally, this is a quote. Some of the things that we will frequently push back on them are, is like, okay, that may be true that you've been sitting on the same pew, and although the reality you've painted, that is a reality for you. And have you had the conversation that only you two can have in this moment now when it comes to discernment, particularly around land and stewarding of the assets of a faith community? The answer almost always is no. So one-to-ones in general are the cornerstone of any organizing effort. If you're not having real human-to-human conversations with people who are around your community, how are you going to move forward? You haven't done the most basic thing, which is to encounter another human being and hear their story. So when we talk about building trust, this can be person to person. It can be between an organizer and a larger community of different community members. Sometimes it can even be broadened out to a bit to a community and people in power, even organizer to organizer, if it's going to be an ongoing effort, which sometimes the discernment processes that we accompany can look like more political efforts in the beginning than they look like, say, redevelopment or land stewardship efforts, because all of it ultimately is political. So these are just some of the things that kick off why one-to-ones are essential. So just to ground us, in case, in the off chance, anyone has not been in a sort of intentional one-to-one meeting, one-to-one meetings can be used for many things. So we use them, of course, for discernment, for evaluation, not in the sense of giving somebody a test or making them jump to meet a certain standard, but just to see where they're at, for instance, in their political education. We never want to assume that someone knows things that they don't know, that they're in community with people that they're simply not in community with. So you have to have a conversation intentionally around that. Setting intentions. So, for example, if you're entering into a community that maybe you haven't had a lot of interface with, you can start off by trying to come in good faith, particularly if it's sort of you're starting at zero, and set the intention of how your interactions may look, or you would like the interactions to look moving forward, because that's a way of setting a standard for accountability moving forward and also building trust like we talked about before. Of course, tending to harm. So this is the other side of accountability, right? Something has happened. It's time for repair. Instead of doing it on the internet, as is often the case nowadays, or taking it to an op-ed, is the sort of passive-aggressive thing we do in Seattle, speaking to our context, you can tend to that harm one-to-one if that's possible. Now, of course, every situation is different, but a one-to-one meeting can often alleviate a lot of the embarrassments that can come from doing things publicly for no good reason. Another thing is communicating the why. Oftentimes we get into really major work with people, sometimes years-long campaigns, and never actually know why they're there. What is the thing that motivates them to stay in this, even when the meetings are long and hard, or when we know they have so much other stuff going on, but they keep showing up? So communicating that why for yourself, hearing that why from someone else, that's something that you can use to galvanize others in the community who may not see why they need to be involved. But hey, this person I'm talking to, having this one-to-one with, they have this why. Oh, you have it too? Great, join this effort. So one-to-one meetings, super effective. So a couple of other things, establishing and sustaining organizing relationships, collaborating on visioning, strategy, and or tactics. That's my favorite one, personally. It feels like conspiracy, which if you break down that word, it literally just means to breathe together, right? Mm-hmm. So super fun time conspiring together. And addressing questions and assumptions. We don't need to leave any stone unturned. People questioning why people are showing up to certain spaces, and we could have that conversation and address those things from the jump. And, of course, so many other things one-to-one meetings are effective for. So just as sort of something to take in with you, we're going to go over a few other things to consider as you go into your own one-to-one conversations around land stores specifically. So we use this image. It's usually part of a much longer sort of like 45-minute one-to-one organizing training, but we pulled it out for this purpose because it communicates an important concept that we want to share with you all. So we'll ask, like, what is below, what is above? Before I get into this, I do want to see, has anyone ever sort of seen the iceberg image before, maybe in a different context? Okay, cool, so there's some familiarity. Right, so the overall concept of this is used in a lot of different ways to communicate different ideas. But in our context, the iceberg, you know, you see it, let's pretend like you're in the Titanic, for example. You see the iceberg, oh, it's not that big. You know, maybe we can get around it. You know how that worked out.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, the iceberg is massive. It's huge, right? There's so much that you can't see, but it's just as, if not more important, I would say probably more important than what you can see. And oftentimes when we have conversations with people, even intentional conversations like one-to-ones, all of what people want to show us is what we can see above the surface, right? So that could be titles, that could be past experiences that are kind of well-known. It could be their position in the community. It can be the sort of glossy version of a certain story, which I think that is the most important one as we go into this land story, or the glossy version, not of just their story, but of their family's story, or potentially of salient political groups that they may, you know, be a part of. So that's, you know, people ultimately have the right to share as much or as little as they would like. You cannot make someone share more than what they're giving you. But it is important to be aware of the fact that that's something that can happen and try to ask questions or listen for little clues, which we'll talk about in a second, that can help you get a little bit below the surface. Because the thing that's actually useful in a one-to-one conversation is not the flashy title. It's not the glossy version of the story. Sometimes it's kind of, it's the dark, it's the cold, it's the ugly, right? Sometimes. Sometimes it's just the thing that maybe as they're articulating it to you, they realize, oh, I've never told this to anyone before. Because no one ever asked, right? That's the meat that you want to get to. And at the same time, if you're having this conversation or you feel like someone is going into the sort of below the surface territory, let them share as much as they would like to share, right? We're not going in here to be extractive, pull out somebody's story only for the express purpose of using it towards the next goal or the next gain or checking something off of a list. This is about encountering another human being as authentically and truthfully as possible. Okay, so during your one-to-one, which we're about to get into in a few moments here, here are some things that we wanted, just sort of things for you to consider that can maybe be helpful as you're listening to folks share. So be attentive and notice some clues. Where do your whys overlap? Where do they diverge? How does that relate back to your purpose for the meeting, which will be around land stories, which we'll explain in a moment? And how might that begin to inform next steps moving forward? And so this is actually pretty interesting, particularly the last one, because that really talks about what we're going to be doing the next 2 days.
You can tell. Can you tell them what you mean by your whys overlapping?
Sure, yes. So the why could be, it depends on how people tell the story, but your why could be, why did you come to this space today? Why are you sharing your land story in a certain type of way? Why are you committed to the work? Why are you committed to the work of land stewardship? Why are you even questioning anything about what's happened in the past? Right? All these different whys are just something to listen to and see if they match your own. If you have any, you may not even know what your why is, but you might hear something that kind of rings in your ear and you're like, yeah, okay, that sits well with me as well. I need to go back to the cabin and maybe think about that. Right? But then also, where do they diverge? That's not necessarily a bad thing. It just means that you're in it for different reasons. Maybe you came to the session for a different reason. There's nothing wrong with that at all. That's great. Now you can maybe connect to hear, oh, this is why I'm here, this is why you're here. Cool, we can still do potentially really great work together over the course of the next few days, or even afterward, if, you know, we exchange contact information. Okay. We also just want to say that listening and learning to this a little bit yesterday, but they're very intimately, like almost inextricably tied. We do separate them in the organizing cycle because there's different processes for learning. And as we say here, listening is uncovering what we need to learn. Learning is preparing ourselves with the skills and information we need to act. Right, so each one is a bridge to the other. So we learn in order to see the world and our place in it clearly. Learning is educating ourselves and forming relationships that move us toward accountable action. We do not learn alone, but in community.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, we touched on this yesterday, but a lot of folks get stuck at learn because you can never stop learning, right? There's always more learning to do. Part of, you know, leaning into transformational values like abundance is recognizing we know enough to do something. Once you've achieved like enough learning, enough skills, enough solidarity and connections with other people that there is something that you can do, you know, you then have a responsibility to move into that action. You can't neglect that action because it's not big enough or it's not, you know, earth-shattering enough for you to do it. You have a moral obligation to act at all times. And so the moment that you have enough learning, abundance kicks in where you say, we have enough to do this next step, take that next step. Don't get stuck in the learning cycle.
Or the fear of failure because you feel like you're not maybe the person to act or something.
Right. Like if we fight, we might lose. But if we don't fight, we've already lost. It's kind of like that sometimes.
It is 100% of the shots you don't take. All right, we can move forward. Okay, so what is a land story? It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a story about land and our relationship to it, as an individual, as a family, as a faith community, and so forth. Today we're going to get into a process of working through personal land stories. When we say personal, we also want to say that I may be a person, and I bring with me my ancestors, I bring with me my family, I bring with me, like, the place that I come from, right? So we don't want to get hung up on the individual piece of it. We know that all of these things are different roads that go towards one that tell a larger story, but we just want to acknowledge that there's different levels at which you could tell this and sort of frame what you're doing. So we just want to talk a little bit more about what exactly a land story is and where does it come from, because we believe in attribution, as we did not come up with this uniquely. So it's a storytelling practice rooted in truth-telling and level-setting. By being truthful and honest about our relationship to land, whether that has been as land invaders, land owners, land stewards, a bit of all of those things, or maybe just being someone who's trying to figure it out, we're able to level-set or be grounded in an intentional conversation about what has been done to the land by us and or our ancestors, what is currently happening, perhaps most importantly, what we can do moving forward to be in right relationship with the land that we're on and communities that have been dispossessed from that land. So giving credit where credit is due, this actually comes from, it's sort of a practice that we're remixing. It comes from money/wealth stories, which have been made popular by a group called Resource Generation. Now, they're not the only ones who ever, you know, have dared to talk about money with other people with intention, but they've kind of popularized the formula of going deeper than just the surface when it comes to talking about money, because as we know in our context, it's difficult enough for us to even talk about our salaries. For example, never mind how do we come into wealth or not, right? That is a much deeper conversation that goes to a systemic level.
Which is a great example of how secrecy as withholding information for the purpose of conserving power. There's a reason why people feel uncomfortable sharing stories about their salary or wealth overall.
Mm-hmm. So shout out to them for making this a bigger thing and also for mobilizing and organizing with young people specifically who have access to wealth towards redistribution. So Resource Generation we're looking into. Okay, so now I'm just going to get into some of the instructions. First, right now, take a moment to find a one-to-one partner in the room. So just one other person in the room that you'd like to have a conversation with. And give a thumbs up once you've found each other, so we know. Found each other. Great.
I feel like we're missing out on a great story. I was looking forward to hearing more about the 70s, but I don't know. We'll talk later. I don't have
partners. Okay, you got partners here. You go to our partners over here.
Nope.
Okay, beautiful. Well, so we've got everybody partnered up. Yeah. Okay, you already did the next step, which was like getting close to each other. All right, wonderful. So in a moment, we're going to have 10 minutes of preparation. We're going to play some soft music for folks just to kind of fill the space, you know, get into the thinking vibe. To jot down some notes to help you if you're the type of person who likes to jot down notes, because you know this could be a lot of information to share with another person. For you to share a personal land story with your one-to-one partner, we'll give you some things to consider in a moment that will help you shape this story. After that 10 minutes of preparation, we'll get into 20 minutes of one-to-one practice, which we've broken down by 10 minutes per each partner. We'll keep time up here so we'll let you know when it's time to switch. You don't have to worry about looking at the clock or looking at your phone or whatever it may be, your watch. But that'll be the time. So once again, I just want to reiterate here, this is not an exercise in perfection. Perfection is not even at Holden Village. We've left it downlink. It's in Lucerne or someplace else, Chelan maybe. This is an exercise in truth-telling and level setting, right? And then last, we'll have roughly 20-ish minutes for group sharing. We just want to reiterate that you'll be as free to share as much or as little of your story as you'd like. And we'd love to hear from as many folks as possible. So once again, so we can hear some of those whys, some of those convergences, divergences, etc. Does that make sense for folks before I move on? See some thumbs up. I love a thumbs up. Check in. Okay, great. Cool. Okay, so these are some questions to consider. And we can leave these up because we know that, you know, this is quite a lot here. So in general with these stories, we find that it's helpful for folks. Particularly, I'll speak to the white folks in the room. People sometimes want to move to the intellectual space, to the systemic analysis, before we've even grounded ourselves or yourselves in what is the story itself, right? So we're trying not to do that by starting off with the individual, the smallest unit, and then moving out from that piece to the systemic. So on the left side, you'll see sort of the more individual questions, and these are just prompts, right? So you can structure it however you want, but what is your personal relationship to the land where you live? Just answering that question. How did you come to live there, maybe? That could be a good way of entering into the story. What do you appreciate about where you live? It could be about the beauty, it could be about the people, whatever it may be for you. Answering that question. And then after you kind of laid some of the groundwork, because this is also about telling the other person, right? They probably have no idea, unless you all came together, about your context. So then going to the systemic. So considering your background in the context of, and these are just examples as well, but some of the more salient ones when it comes to this conversation, race, ethnicity, class, faith identity, immigration status, if that's relevant, and any other salient identities that come up for you, and consider some of the overarching questions. So how do these things show up in your relationship to land? And this can also be expanded to your family's relationship to land, potentially. How have they shown up in, once again, your family's relationship to land? How are you grappling with these realities in the present, or how have you, if at all, and how might you, right? So this could be, if you are grappling with it, that's great. Maybe what are you aspiring to do in the future? If you're not grappling with these things, having a little bit of imagination, right? How might you do these things? Is that making sense for folks? These are big questions, right? So don't get hung up on any one of them. You don't have to answer all of them. These are just guides to kind of help the conversation. Cool. If that's, well,
I mean, it's probably a question I have to answer myself, but are we expecting that a lot of people that are living here for a year or two would be talking about Holden Village land?
That's a personal question. But I think it's a worthwhile one. I think if you consider it home, I think home is helpful here. So whatever the place is that you feel a sense of responsibility to directly in this moment, that's probably the best place to kind of ground what you're responding to here.
Thank you.
Okay.
We have a saying. Going a mile deep, an inch wide is more effective than going a mile wide, an inch deep. There might be a lot of places that you're connected to, and I think for the purpose of this exercise, like maybe focusing on one and doing like a really deep intentional look at it, it might be more effective. But that's up to you ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm seeing some head nods, got some eye contact, so I think we're ready to get into the time. And once again, if you need to keep it for yourself, you know, you like to know generally what the flow looks like, this is the flow. It's going to hang out over here.
You're basically saying, technically, we should have not come together because we should do our thing first, and then we're going to do the 20 minutes is when we actually talk together.
Yes.
Kind of, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Sit next to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, you can, like, feel each other's energy. Right. Well, maybe look at the penmanship. Does it look, you know, keep it? A little bit of judgment. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, great. Lily, are we ready with the tunes?
Yeah, we'll play a little bit of music for y'all. If you have any requests, feel free to let the DJ know.
Yeah, if there's any volunteers to kind of kick us off and get us started, feel free.
Go ahead. That's all right. Talking about my wife's family, actually, but I feel that because, you know, that's where I've been for 30 more parts of my life than I have anywhere else. We've lived on the land for 30 years. Her family has been there for, since the late 1890s. My children are the second or fifth generation on the property, and we are very blessed and privileged. We have her mother owns the 80 acres behind us, so we have no neighbors behind us. We are next to a state park, a small state park, so we have no neighbors to our, I guess it's our west. And we live about 8 miles from the city, the biggest city out in Minnesota. And I, my thing was that, you know, there was a thing where the Blacks band, I think the Ojibwe, they had a big argument when I first lived there, which was in the 80s for a few years to go to school, and they were going to net fish in one of the biggest lakes, and everybody, all the white people basically were upset about this, and I'm saying, but you have the rest of the lakes, you know, pretty much in the state. But that was a big argument, and as I was living where I'm at, I started thinking about, like we talked about earlier this morning at the other event, about how, you know, all of a sudden Oklahoma had switched over, like it was their land, and what would happen if all of a sudden this was their land. The treaty was, you know, like they did to be able to fish. The treaty said that they could fish there. And so they won that argument. And I thought, you know, I would hope that I could do something. But in reality, after all this stuff that I've learned here and in other places, is that I would have justified it, that we deserve it. And, you know, it's not me. It's our kids. I don't want to take it away from our kids. You know, I would have, you know, and it's just scary about how I think human beings are set up to justify what they've done. And that kind of scares me about owning land anywhere, and what, how you got it and why you have it.
Easy for that scarcity mentality to just kind of dominate something.
Yeah.
I mean, it creates that binary of like either our children get to have it,
right,
or no one gets to have it.
Right. And the other thing that goes to that is I was thinking about, well, when their Swedish relatives came here, I mean, they were poor. My wife's mom would say, they were land rich and money poor, mm-hmm, until, you know, later on, and, you know, after all, they had paid for the kids' college and everything else. You know, they had more money. You know, they were more into the wealthier part, and they could sell the land now, you know, because they don't farm it, so they could have it. But they worked hard. They were poor when they came here. They were fleeing places. They deserved this land because, you know, it wasn't being used. You know, that kind of idea that white people have. You know, you weren't out farming it with a tractor like we are, so it wasn't being used or whatever. So those are kind of justifications, too.
That spark anything to anyone else? Were there any places where that had overlapped? Are those justifications as you laid out? What justifications you also found yourself making, or maybe others in your family have made in any of your stories?
I can't hear in this setting.
Mm.
Oh. And so in the last session, I asked folks that they would just take their mask up when they spoke, and they were willing to do that.
We can also have folks that are comfortable with that. I can repeat.
Thank you.
Okay, that's helpful. Great. Yes, so I was saying, was there anything in that, what he just shared, that resonated? with anyone else's story? Were there any overlaps, any places of convergence that you heard? And this is for everyone. If so, I would invite you to share if you feel so led. We can pass the mic as well.
Sure. I don't know if it'll help me. Yeah, my history is also Swedish. In Nebraska and farmland, and I think that notion of how hard we work on our land, and but then more recently when I thought about when we don't let people on our southern border because they're taking our land, it's pretty condemning to have that thought. That we know what it is to own our land, but we don't. I'll just talk about me. I am fortunate that I own a condo that I live in. Those were the cards I was dealt. But the notion of owning dirt,
soil,
is kind of
soil, please.
Soil, not dirt. Soil.
Oh, all right.
Dirt is dead.
Okay. The notion of owning the soil, which I don't. I just own my condo, but. It's not ours. And I would say, also, it's not really the native peoples either, but they have stewarded where they have lived better than most of people that look like me. So, that's what I'll say. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a question to offer?
In response, you can pass the mic.
Thanks for sharing, Matt. I think I would encourage us just to stick to what we're talking about when it comes to our story. We don't need to, at this moment, compare it to other people's stewardship of the land. I don't think that's a particularly helpful exercise. And so in this moment, I just want to bring us back to what the overall sort of question is that we're answering. I know there was a number of questions under it, which is informing some of this, but what is your personal relationship to the land, however you interpreted that question?
Well, yeah, I want to talk about what I'm sort of grappling with out of this story. So my grandfather and grandmother also were immigrants. They came here in 1905, 1907. I was able to find at Ellis Island the document that described who my grandfather was, and one of the things that was in the document was that, you know, how much money did he have, and he had $5 when he came over here. Fast forward 17 years, I live in a home in California, and I was talking to Janine and Anne-Marie about the fact that when I bought that home with my wife 13 years ago, I paid what I thought was an exorbitant amount of money for a home in the town. It was $750,000. And in California, even back then, that was not considered a whole lot of money, to be honest, for a home in a community. It you know, it's crazy to think that, but that was less than the median in, you know, price in the community that I lived in. And Janine asked me about taxes, and the way the California set up is that you pay your property tax based on when you bought the house, and then it can't go up more than 1% a year. Well, now that house is valued 13 years later at $1.5 million. Right? I'm paying the taxes that somebody who bought a house today, about 60% of the price of my house. think about the equity issue there, right? And this is, and then the other crazy part, of course, is you all have, you know, who don't live in California, but no, you hear the stories about homelessness or unhousedness in California. So we have all this appreciate, quote unquote, appreciation and value of my home and other people's homes at the same time as we can't find a way to house people. That disconnect is very hard to deal with. I mean, my grandfather left because of, you know, oppression, pogroms, you know, his property and his family's property being burned down on a regular basis. So I'm glad he made that decision so I could be here in this situation. But now I'm stuck with this issue where I've got this value, quote unquote, that is, you know, ultimately in conflict with my values. Right? So that's what I'm grappling with out of the exercise.
I'll add one little piece of that. Prop 13.
That's what I was referring to.
But Prop 13 is even more than that. Because Prop 13, that was like 1982, so about the time the boomers came in control of the government, they initiated this proposition that their taxes would never go up on their land, on their property. And not only that, but if they moved to the adjoining county, they carry Prop 13
right.
with them.
That's right.
So it never increases. So if you owned your home in 1982 and continue to live in that home or move to adjoining county, your property taxes are the same that they were in 1982.
That's not exactly right. They can go up 1% a year.
Yeah.
That's what I was referring to. But effective, it's the same basic point.
Yeah. But you didn't move from an adjoining county, right, when you bought your home for $795 or whatever.
I moved within the same county.
Mm-hmm.
The property tax is set based on the purchase price that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So the purchase price I had in 2008 was $750,000. It's only gone up 15% since then, even though the value has gone up 100%. Mm-hmm. That's the inequity.
Yes.
Right.
This will be our last share. Passing it around.
There's a convergence because my grandfather also fled Russia under the pogroms, got here about 10 years before yours, it sounds like. And as I understand it, he came with some hunger for land because it was not allowed for Jews to own land in Eastern Europe. And so he made his way as a young teenager to Montana. And even though I now live in Washington, Montana is always my home. And so where I went in our conversation is about the fact that my grandfather, even though he set up a business in Butte, Montana, total extractive community, he purchased two of the Homestead Act plots from the railroad, who got it for free. And then when they were done with it, and that has now passed on down in the family to my generation. And the 636 acres, in eastern Montana, on which nobody lives, but cattle graze and antelope jump and all of those beautiful things. I had never really visited the land until it sort of came to be my responsibility as part of a limited liability corporation that we set up to help steer the direction on what we were going to do with this land that was occasioned by the offer of some oil leasing, fracking specifically. And there's six kids of the grandfather, and my particular family blocked that contract by all of us voting together not to do that, which led the other families to feel that it's not being used if we're not going to, you know, this was the dream of earlier generations that someday there'd be oil there. So in the negotiations internally, we did decide to sell the land to the people who were leasing it. And so that money is going to come into our hands at the end of 2023. And thanks to the last 2 days, I always come out of here with some kind of agenda from Holden around awareness that we're now the beneficiaries of the Homestead Act. And so I would like to get into a dialogue with my many cousins, with whom I don't always share this, around could we do something with the proceeds that honors and recognizes that this land was stolen in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of thinking to do, and yet this is a very long distance thing. You know, as you know, Montana's a wide country. So, anyway, that's kind of where I'm at.
Feel free to pass it this way.
Thank you all for kind of starting further into this process, getting some one-to-one practice in. Sometimes it can feel like kind of scary for folks to be like, I'm doing what and how? And it really doesn't have to be so formalized, right? We're trying to work on that second violence of how we impose the culture of white supremacy on folks. And I need to hold it closer? Okay. And it's really interesting, you know, in some ways how stories, like, connect. I am so happy, right, that you're already looking to start a discernment process of your own, like, with your family. That's where we hope that folks start, right, with themselves, their immediate community, and then branching out. So hopefully, you know, these next couple sessions we can hand you some more tools to do that. This is just, like, the start. Past this, then you have to do the same process but with a whole congregation or a faith community, right? Like, what is your faith community's history and connection to the land? So we're going to get into some of that. I'm going to move on to... Oh, you got me. Thanks. Sweet. So now that we've kind of started this process on the listening and learning part of the organizing spiral as it relates to land discernment, tomorrow we're going to move into act and reflect. So we've kind of interrogated our history, like how we got here. What are you going to do about it now? We're going to talk about that. And then how do you reflect once you've taken an action? Then what? The quote that I always say from Miriam Kaba that her father said is, what are you going to do the day after the revolution? Because that day might come. So focusing on the reflect stage. And then Friday, this is where we're kind of start you off, right? You're going to begin your own discernment process as it relates to this with a visioning exercise. So it's going to be super fun. Going to get some art supplies out. So we hope that we'll be able to see some of y'all there. And we'll be here both of those days, same time, same place. So thank you so much for being here. I know it's not easy once your blood sugar drops after that 10 a.m. coffee. Yeah. But we really appreciate you making the time. So thanks so much.